Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Glad to have you all with us for this edition of the show. If you're listening to us in real time, this is Friday at the end of a very busy primary election week. Jim Galloway is here with us, the lead political writer for the AJC, columns in Wednesday and Sunday's newspapers. You're glad this week is coming to an end.
Man, my butt is just dragging.
Thank you so much for putting that image in our heads, Mr. Galloway. Rusty Paul is also here. He's the mayor of Sandy Springs. He is the former chair of the state Republican Party, the Georgia State Republican Party. He's a Washington guy as well. He worked with Jack Kemp, the great late Jack Kemp, when he was Secretary of HUD, and also when he ran his presidential campaign. We used to see each other out there on the campaign trail every now and then. Rusty, thank you for coming
Good to be here again.
And Senator Jen Jordan from Senate District 6, which is mostly Fulton and a little bit of Cobb, or is it a little mixture of both?
It's about half and half, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Democratic senator from that district has an opponent in the general, and we've invited her opponent at some point to come in, too, because we want to be fair about this. But we're really happy you could join us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Before we introduce one more member of our panel today, let me just give you a couple quick notes. Of course, we are on Facebook Live right now. Just go to the GPB News Facebook page, and you will find us there. We all look really good today, so I hope a lot of people are watching. You can leave comments there, too. We'd love to hear what you have to say on Facebook Live. And if you are not in a place where you can watch us, then when you're listening, tweet us at PoliticsGPB. I also want to remind you again that we would love to have you, if you're down in the Columbus area, join us for the show that we're going to record in front of a live audience on Thursday night, June 7th. I checked with our community affairs people, and they say, and we got a really close to 200 people right now signed up. So if you want to join us, it's free, and you probably will be able to get in if you just come. But if you go to gpb.org/community, you'll see the venue, you'll see the time, 7 o'clock at night, and you can register to be in the audience for that show. So we'd love to have you join us there. Okay, announcements out of the way. As we end this week, we are going to want to assess where we stand in terms of what we learned about voters in this week. More and more data has become available as the week has gone on, and we want to talk about where the race, particularly for governor, is headed. And to start today, we invited Emily Cureton, a reporter in the Atlanta office of GPB, who last night was at the annual Georgia Democratic Party dinner. Jim, they used to call it the JJ,
the Jefferson Jackson
dinner, but now they're more politically correct.
That's out of fashion.
What do they call it now? Do you know, Emily?
Yeah, you had it right the first time, the Democratic State Dinner. And it's what it is it's the state party's biggest fundraiser of the year. So there were 900 supporters gathered at the Hyatt Regency in Atlanta.
Jen Jordan was one of them. So
I was, and the food was excellent, actually.
Okay, well, and we'll let you're more than welcome to weigh in as Emily talks. But last night was really an important night for the Democrats, wasn't it? They've got their nominee for governor. Stacey Abrams won a huge victory on Tuesday night, won by more than 50 points in all parts of the state. She won all but six counties. Six counties.
Most of those in North Georgia.
Up in the northwest corner. So, Emily, this was a night where they could proclaim they are unified moving forward. Is that basically what they tried to do?
That is certainly a theme that I heard. The rallying around the nominee is not only Stacey Abrams, but another part of this historic ticket is Sarah Riggs Amico. She's a candidate for lieutenant governor. So they have two women at the top of the ballot for November. And you heard a lot of enthusiasm about that last night. Actually, the Senate Minority Leader Steve Hansen squeaked by in the primary, and he spoke last night. His counterpart in the House, Bob Trammell, had the 15 women who are running for legislative seats stand up for a round of applause. So women were certainly celebrated. And one thing I heard over and over was this call to give people not just something to vote against and the sort of partisan divisive politics, but something to vote for and to stay focused on the issues. So the headline speaker was Doug Jones. That's how he capped off his speech. He also stumped for Abrams and in maybe an unexpected turn compared his campaign against Roy Moore to Herman.
Yeah, let's remind people that Doug Jones was the is the Democrat who beat Roy Moore for a U.S. Senate seat in Alabama, a typically unfriendly state for Democratic statewide candidates. But Doug Jones won it.
Let me tell you, folks, let me tell you that as someone who no one gave a snowball's chance in hell of becoming a U.S. senator, I am here to tell you, she not only can do it, she will do it.
So, okay, Emily, let's talk about this with the panel for a minute. Jim, of course, Doug Jones is a big name now in the Democratic Party in the South, given his victory in Alabama. I'm finding it interesting because any number of people writing about this race have talked about the Doug Jones model in Alabama in terms of what Stacey Abrams can accomplish here. Is that a valid comparison?
Some elements are, especially when it comes to really activating the African-American base there. But you also had in Alabama, you had Roy Moore.
Yeah.
and so far, Brian Kemp and Casey Cagle aren't Roy Moore. And so you didn't have that stampede of suburban white Republicans into the Democratic camp.
Yeah, Jen Jordan, when you listened to Doug Jones last night, what were your thoughts? Is he a valid comparison?
You know, I think it is a valid comparison. I think what we learned from Doug's race or from Senator Jones's race is that you have to get out and you have to touch people and you have to go where people are. You have to go to them. And one of the things that we have not been doing in Georgia as Democrats is actually focusing on field work and going to people and knocking on doors and touching them, especially outside of the Atlanta area. And I think that if we do that, I mean, we've really got a shot here.
Well, I don't think there's a lot of comparison. I mean, first of all,
let's remind people you are from rural Alabama.
I grew up five miles from Roy Moore. The difference over there, and there's a similarity in Alabama politics. You've got the rural, conservative, largely religious vote, which is what got Roy Moore the nomination to begin with. And then you've got the areas around Birmingham and Mobile and Montgomery and Auburn and Tuscaloosa, which are more, they tend to be Republican, but they're not really socially conservative, and they just could not abide Roy Moore as their senator. And I think there was a lot of crossover vote that you saw in that race that will not necessarily, as Jim indicated, would be in this one. But it's going to be interesting because there's some really, and I know we'll get into this later, the numbers coming out of Tuesday are fascinating for those of us who are political scientists and dig into the numbers.
Yeah, we are going to get into those numbers because they do show a shift is in the wind. It actually started arriving on Tuesday night. So we will talk about that in a few minutes. But the crowd must have eaten up Doug Jones, Emily.
They did. I mean, in some ways, I think he was the last speaker of the night, and I felt like he was really upstaged by Stacey Abrams, actually. Oh. She came on for a much shorter period of time. She spoke for about 5 minutes, and it was after other speakers had gotten up there and really hearkened on the civil rights movement, drawing comparisons to today. And when she got to the mic, the very first thing she did was thank all of the workers at the hotel and the people serving the food and cleaning up the plates. And then she thanked Stacey Evans and thanked her for promoting party unity. And I think the term she said was, "And now we can kick their butts." So there was this message of unity. And then the numbers you're talking about, where it really was a historic day for Democratic turnout, something like the last numbers I've seen was a 68% boost in the number of ballots cast over the 2014 primary. Stacey Abrams spoke directly to that. Here's what she said.
Republicans lost people on the way to the polls. Despite threatening to deport, detain, and deter, they found themselves distracted by a runoff that will take 9 more weeks. And while they are toiling in the vineyards trying to figure out who they are, Democrats will be finding everybody we need to get to the ballot boxes in November.
Stacey Abrams at the party dinner last night. She did have Stacey Evans sitting quite close to her, I think.
Yeah, that's
after
true.
Dinner. And Jen, Stacey Evans immediately on Tuesday night after losing rallied for Stacey Abrams. That's a good sign for your party.
Yeah, absolutely. And earlier in the day, too, there was a winless luncheon where they were both present. And it was the first time that they were both kind of in the room together after Tuesday night. And the message was clear from the Evans camp, which is we're all in for Stacey. It may not have been the Stacey we exactly wanted, but at this point in time, we have to look at who's on the other side of the V right now.
Yeah, the win list being Melita Easters. You've heard her on our show as a panelist, the organization that she founded to promote women Democratic pro-choice candidates, all of those things. And I know Melita was very excited that she was able to put together a luncheon with the brand new Democratic candidate. So, Emily, did you sense in that room that this really is, the words were good. Was there the kind of energy and excitement that you think is going to be able to propel Democrats forward to do what Jen Jordan just talked about, really get out there and work on behalf of their candidates?
That's a really tough question to answer at this point. I mean, it's a risky strategy to try to get people to vote who normally don't turn out. I certainly felt a lot of energy in the room when Stacey Abrams spoke. One thing that the evening was a little bit light on was really specific issues, and that makes sense at a large fundraiser. However, healthcare was not something that was skirted. Stacey Abrams specifically called for expanding Medicaid in just her 5 minutes on the microphone. And brought up education as well, something that was noticeably absent to me, except perhaps in the speech of Lieutenant Governor candidate Sarah Riggs Amico, was talk of gun laws and gun reform that we've seen so much protest over in recent months. She brought it up. Really, no one else did. So I think that last night I saw a lot of energy and also kind of an appeal. Doug Jones actually appealed to this directly for Democrats to stick with the issues that bring people together.
Right. You know, Rusty, two things that Emily just said caught my attention. One, Stacey Abrams emphasizing expansion of Medicaid. Smart. I mean, that's the sort of issue that can cut across party lines, clearly.
Well, it definitely can cut across economic lines. And there's a compassion issue that, no matter which side of the political divide you're on, compassion always works.
You think I may be overstating it to think that there are Republican voters who would like that message?
I don't know that they would like the message. I'm not sure it's strong enough to get them in and out
okay,
of itself.
That makes sense.
Oh, look, you've got the Georgia Chamber who is backing Casey Cagle, or appears to be backing Casey Cagle. I don't know that they've made a formal choice. Because he has left himself open to Medicaid expansion in some form.
On the other hand, what's interesting too, Jen, is Emily's observation that there wasn't a lot of talk about gun control measures. Stacey Abrams says over and over again that her campaign and her people say, we're going to try to run a race aimed at progressive voters and finally turn them out to the polls. You would think that gun control would be, at some point, it's going to have to come into play in this campaign, or no? Do they try to be low-key about that?
Well, if I could jump in here, I think that we still have the 6th District runoff to get through, and Lucy McBath and Kevin Abel are in there, and I think there might have been some thought that if you weigh into that issue—
You're tipping the balance towards McBath. Oh, that makes perfect sense. What do you think, though, about that issue, Jen?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I know definitely in terms of my district, it's one of the most important issues in terms of what constituents talk to me about. And if you want to talk about crossover vote in terms of Republicans who may be disenchanted with the Republican Party and looking for a candidate, their number one issue for a lot of these mothers is the gun issue. And so if we're looking to kind of pull people in, it may not be Medicaid expansion, but it definitely could be gun.
Okay. Emily Curtin, really appreciate your coming in for a few minutes to talk with us about this. Do you agree with Jen Jordan? Did they serve a good dinner last night?
Yeah, the food was great.
They do feed the media.
They did feed me. Yeah, I made my way to a nice plate of caprese. So, thanks for having me, Bill. It's always great to be here.
Thanks. All right. So Why don't we do this? Why don't we get a break out of the way and come back? Jim, you walked into the studio right after Rusty Paul and Jen Jordan started talking to each other about the data they've been crunching since Tuesday. And they've got some interesting numbers. Ooh, and I know you're going to have information to add to that. So let's pick up on that when we get back. This is Political Rewind.
You know, selling a car can be a hassle, but donating it is a whole different story. Let us take it off your hands or off your driveway and turn it into public radio and maybe even a tax deduction. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace, and here is how to donate.
Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
Welcome back to Rewind. State Senator, Democratic State Senator Jen Jordan, Republican Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul, and Jim Galloway are at the table. Before we get into the data crunching, we talked a bit about Abrams and the energy that Democrats think she has moving forward. Jim, the Republicans in Washington and here in Georgia went on the attack as quickly as they could after she became the nominee. Let's listen to the Republican Governors Association commercial about her.
Meet Stacey Abrams. She wants to be president, only using Georgia as a stepping stone. Wants higher taxes on working families, but can't pay her own taxes. Stacey Abrams, out for herself, not Georgia. Paid for by RGA Georgia 2018 PAC.
Jim, there is nothing in that commercial that we did not anticipate, that the Abrams campaign did not anticipate would be thrown at her.
And it's a topic that the Evans campaign actually stayed away from.
Yeah, yeah.
What you have is the typical effort by a party to kind of take the fight on its own to a candidate while its party is still sorting out who its nominee is going to be.
Right.
So clearly that's why it was intended. The topic and the visuals. This is radio. You can't see the visuals, but they were very dark. And I'm guessing that the hues that they used darkened Ms. Abrams' complexion even further. So it's kind of an inkling of what we're going to be facing in September, October, and November.
Rusty, it's a age-old rule in politics: define your opponent before he or she can define him or herself.
And that's obviously what's going to happen. And I think you're going to see a lot of outside money in this race. I mean, the Republican Party understands that Stacey Abrams is a unique candidate, and that this would be a true historic election if she gets elected governor. And so I think nationally that they will do everything they can, because they've, as we get into the numbers, you're going to see that there's some key Republican areas that the state party is going to have to defend that they've never really had to defend before. And so it's going to be a real challenge. It's define your opponent before they define themselves.
Jen, how tough is it going to be to fight back against these accusations? Because they are, in fact, provable in the sense that she has had debt that she's had to explain a little bit during the primary season. But as Jim points out, Stacey Evans didn't use it against her. So it isn't as if these are false charges. They're going to have to have. I know what she says is, that's right. I'm just like you. I have debts. I can understand you better because I'm as human as you are.
Look, I think it's a little disingenuous for the Republican Party to act like they care about tax issues or problems with the IRS in light of President Trump and all of his issues. So it doesn't really seem real to me. It doesn't seem like it's going to be an attack that's really going to actually land kind of a significant blow to her. And then secondarily, the part of the ad about how, well, she wants to be president. Look, every man who runs for political office thinks he's going to be president of the United States. It's a little offensive that they're attacking her because she's a woman and because she actually aspires to do something more.
Yeah,
you know, in the year of the woman, I don't know if that's the right tack to take.
Interesting. Okay. We'll watch how that develops. We actually got a tweet about that on Wednesday's show that it seemed sexist. I have to say that it strikes me that usually male candidates too are, if they seem to have aspirations for higher office, that's one of the things you pull out. He's not really running to be governor. He's really running to be the next president of the United States. But I think in this moment in which we are so sensitive to what women are dealing with, you may very well have a point, right? All right. You all have some terrific data. I have some that I've collected. And, Jim, some of it comes from stuff that you and your colleagues have been reporting.
All right.
So, Rusty, let me start. What are you looking at that you think is telling in terms of where we're headed?
Well, you look at intensity. And there was a tremendous amount of intensity on the Democratic side. As we've talked, the large number of additional voters that were there. And another thing I look at is what we call fall off. Everybody shows up and votes for the top races. What happens down ballot? On the Republican side, by the time you got the lieutenant governor, 10% had dropped out. And the Secretary of State, which is kind of one of those races that you look at to find what your base is, down to 13%. Interestingly, the fall off on the Democratic side, by the time they got to the Secretary of State race, was only 7%. So those folks came to vote. They came intending to make a statement all up and down the ballot. The real challenge, and particularly for my team going forward, is where a lot of these new Democratic voters. I walked in. I voted at Riverwood High School in Sandy Springs, and my longtime poll manager there. First thing she said to me is, "Man, we've had a large number of our people asking for Democratic ballots." And so that was my first flag. And then I started looking at where these votes were. And it's that whole northern suburban area from Cobb County through North Fulton over to Gwinnett County, where you've had really a tectonic shift. And it's really driven by a couple of things. One, they're economic conservatives, but social libertarians. They're not Trump fans. Rural Georgia, big Trump fans, not so much in these areas. Secondly, RFRA and guns, as Jen said. Brian Kemp's ads were intended to be humorous. And in rural Georgia, they got the humor. In the suburban areas, they wanted to know why he was advocating shooting third graders. That cultural divide that exists politically in Georgia today. And that's where, going forward into the general election, it's going to be a real tricky, and secondly, trying to attack an African-American female by white males is going to be a very tricky process, too. So it's going to be very interesting how they come back into the general election and deal with particularly the gun issue that Brian really injected.
Jim?
Yeah, the down ballot issue, I think, is really important because that's where the Republican Revolution started. It started down ballot with Bobby Baker on the PSC.
Right.
And you've got two really good Democratic candidates in both of those two races, Lindy Miller and I'm blanking on the other name, Deborah.
Don Randolph.
Don Randolph. Right. And so you could see even if Evans. Or Abrams, I'm sorry. If Abrams doesn't win the governor's race, she could bring enough new voters in and really make the difference further down the ballot.
Jen, what were you saying when you crunched some numbers?
So I was seeing the same thing that that Rusty did, and in fact, where he's talking about in terms of geographically around the Metro Atlanta area, if you look at the Republican-held Senate seats. You compare the Republican votes from 2012 to 2018, you see about a 50% fall off in terms of people who pulled those ballots. That's significant.
Wow.
I mean, these are districts that are gerrymandered specifically to be a Republican district.
Just look at Fran Miller. Dunwoody. Mm-hmm. Dunwoody, Sandy Springs, Brookhaven.
Long-time legislator.
Oh, yeah. Been there forever.
Republican. Yeah.
Upside down, there were 3,279 more Democratic votes cast in his Senate district than there were Republicans. In Dunwoody, same thing. Wendell Willard, retiring, our former city attorney, retiring chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, uncontested race, Republicans and Democrat. Democrat,
307
votes difference. In, again, Sandy Springs and Roswell. And again, a very affluent area, an area that traditionally votes 65% plus Republican. And you've had a huge shift, and it's the social issues with Trump that is driving those changes.
You know, it's Bill, it's one thing that I'm not sure that you've talked about on Wednesday, But one of the more significant items that came out of that vote was Josh McCoon's third place finish in the race for Secretary of State.
Yeah, we did, in fact.
And he was the religious liberty guy.
Yeah, you do have to wonder. I think most people assume, Jen, that Josh McCoon would certainly end up in a runoff because of how well-known he became over issues like RFRA, and maybe, in fact, it's what took him down. Now, he would disagree. Josh will say that his problem was he got outraised. He didn't have anywhere near the money that his opponents did and couldn't get his message out.
And that, too, is related to his position as champion of religious liberty.
McCoon, by the way, is going to be on our panel on June 7th when we go to Columbus, as will Calvin Smyrie. So really interesting matchup. Let me throw out some numbers that I got from the AJC and then get you all to respond to them. Jim, here's what your colleagues put together. In the Republican contest for governor, there were 606,215 votes cast. 552,700 of them were on the Democratic side. There were only 53,000 more votes for Republicans than Democrats. So Tuesday's vote represented an increase of a small number of Republicans
1.6%.
Yes, but on the Democratic side, it was this 68% gain.
If you focus on Michelle Nunn's U.S. Senate numbers in 2014, it was a 68% pickup.
All right, is that real, Jen Jordan, or are there other factors to account for this other than an energized Democratic base? Is it that this race was more interesting than the Michelle Nunn, Jason Carter candidacies back in 2014. How do you read that?
No, it's real. It's absolutely real. I mean, it is stunning. I mean, and I'm not quite sure. I think the numbers generally, the gap tends to be about 280 or 250 in terms of the Republican and the Democratic Party. The idea that we have now narrowed it down to 50,000 and we still have so many people to actually touch and get out to the ballot, it really is exciting. I mean, it's one of those things where we've been talking for years about trying to touch these folks and get them out, and now we're actually seeing them show up at the ballot box. And this is a primary, too. I mean, the only people that come to primaries are people, like Rusty was saying, that are there to vote and are intentional about it. Republicans have always been good about it. They always show up. They always vote. And there hasn't really been any room for them to grow because of that, because their people always show up. But with us, they just don't. And so now we're starting to see a shift, and this is, it's pretty incredible. And if this trend continues, I mean, we're going to have a winning ticket in November.
And that's the key issue. If this trend continues, you can't take one election and make a trend out of it. But there are some interesting data here that shows that there are some things, interesting things going on within the electorate of Georgia that bear watching. And the question is this just kind of the perfect storm with Trump and RFRA and guns that are driving these suburban voters to register a protest vote? Or have they really changed their party affiliation? And it's going to take several elections to determine
all right,
that.
But Rusty, that makes the point that I think Doug Jones wanted to make last night at the dinner, and that he has been making and the Democrats are making right now, which is that he was able to convert suburban women to the Democratic Party. Sure, Roy Moore was a terrible candidate, but absent Roy Moore, having a different Republican candidate, it is possible that the Democrats could have found the same successes in Alabama that, at least in the primary vote, Democrats did
here,
Jim.
Well, from what Senator Jordan is saying is that we don't have Roy Moore, but we do have the NRA.
Right.
And it could very well be that becomes the straw man in the coming fall election.
And we also have 9 weeks of a runoff where there's going to be a run to the right. So, you know, it's going to be a really interesting 9 weeks, and it's going to be very hard to then kind of self-correct after that to try to seem like you're more mainstream from the Republican side. And by then, they may have turned off enough people to make it happen for us.
So if you don't look at least occasionally, 538, which is Nate Silver's website Nate Silver, who used to be at the New York Times, is one of the best data crunchers out there in the business, and he's got a great staff. I just put up on the GPB political page, Politics GPB, a link to an article online right now, written by Perry Bacon Jr. And Jim, I thought some of what Perry Bacon had to say is interesting. Number one, he says, yes, it's going to be very tough for Abrams to win. And he uses a phrase. He says Georgia is one of the most inelastic states in the country. And it sort of goes back to something Rusty was talking about.
Yeah. My phrase for it has been stickiness.
Yeah.
There's an inertia with Georgia voters. And sometimes the more you try to push them off a position, the tighter they're going to cling to that position.
Yeah, and he would make the point that in other states, behavior by President Trump, the NRA, issues surrounding abortion rights, all of those things actually have the ability to move people off of their point of view, move them a different direction. In Georgia, and we see this all the time here, it just doesn't happen as much.
I came to Georgia in 1974. One party had overwhelming dominance in both chambers. They had all statewide elected officials. All statewide elected officials were white males. I spent my life trying to change the political parties dominance of this state, and we did.
But
all we did was change the labels. Right now, you've got all white males, and you've got dominance. So that point is very important. It is not, Georgia pretty much stays the same regardless of what the parties do. Now, the issue is there is some things that are happening that have not happened historically.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the interesting thing to see.
I thought the formula that he was
going to share it.
Okay, yeah. you've got Stacey Abrams is going to have to get at least 90% of the minority vote in November.
Right.
And that minority vote has to be greater than the 40% in its raw numbers. It has to be up there to 42-43%.
So, he says for her to win, as you point out, she has to have 90% of the non-white vote. She has to make sure non-whites are 40% of the electorate through get-out-the-vote efforts, which means increasing the African-American vote.
And right now that's about 32-33.
Yes. And then she says she has to win 25% of the white vote, which he says is doable I'm not sure it is, but he thinks it might be. Jen, I found that to be really interesting. Driving up African American participation to lower the overall total voters in such a way that black vote will be more important in the election. Yeah?
I thought he had some interesting points. I think, though, that our approach is going to be to try to drive out everyone to vote, regardless of race or gender. Honestly, even looking historically, I just don't think the data tells us everything. I mean, there is something going on here in this state and in this country. And I think that the numbers that we saw on Tuesday surprised everybody.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I think, Rusty, you're right. I think something different is happening. Mm-hmm. And Jen, you too. And I think what happened on Tuesday night, Bill, was that we saw the end of the Roy Barnes faction in the state Democratic Party. And that's, we're talking about the white male dominance,
mm-hmm. conservative of
Georgia. So yes, we have a new player in the game now.
All right. We will have a lot of time to talk about the Democratic side of this thing. Rusty, I would just very quickly, clearly we're heading into a very, what's going to be a difficult and treacherous runoff between Kemp and Cagle. They've, at least to best of my knowledge, it's been quiet these last couple of days on the Republican side. What are they doing that we're not hearing about right now?
They're sitting there looking at these numbers and trying to figure out where the voters, how best to appeal to the Hunter Hill and Clay Tippins wing of the party. Going in, most of the people that do what I do felt that Casey needed to get over 40% to be, and he was just
close,
just a little short. And so they're trying to figure out how can they win this primary without blowing the general election. Brian Kemp's trying to figure out how to get there. And so he's going to be more aggressive in trying to figure out how to disable Casey's wagon. But it's going to be a real challenge. And Hunter, he'll, you know, first of all, whoever Hunter and Clay decide to endorse, that doesn't automatically mean all their voters are going to go to those candidates. But that's what they're trying to figure out right now, is where those, how do we best get those voters back to the polls and vote for us this time as opposed to the person they voted for
last
time.
So there was a disagreement on the panel on Wednesday over whether Brian Kemp would be likely to continue his, yes, I just said that, line of attack, continue to be out flamboyant with a sense of humor. We get that he's trying to be funny. Will he continue in that vein, or is he going to have to moderate a bit because of Cagle being, you know, at least somewhat more issue-driven in terms of the way he's running? So I'd like to get each of you to weigh in on
Well,
this that.
I'll speak as somebody who's run as a campaign manager in this situation. I am trying to understand what motivated those voters to vote for Hunter Hill. What is the message that's going to get that block of voters to come to me? If they determine that the same message will help them move those voters that direction, they probably will continue more of that. If they determine that it turns those folks off, you'll see a change. And Casey's team's doing the same thing. What do we got to do to get those folks without crippling ourselves so badly that we're handicapped going into November?
I will tell you, Bill, first of all, one of the first things out of Brian Kemp's mouth on Tuesday night, when he was celebrating his runoff berth, was a personal attack on Casey Cagle.
Yep.
And so yes, and then here, the other thing that happened to that Tuesday night was you had a Twitter message sent out by Chris Riley, chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal, who basically said in this runoff, if any candidate goes after our record, then we're going to come back at them hard. Now, what that means is, I mean, Casey Cagle is basically a third term for Nathan Deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes.
he's an extension of that policy. So if Nathan Deal is telling Brian Kemp that you can't attack Casey Cagle on policy, then he's got to attack him on personality.
Well, and that's the real challenge here, because that's why the feeling was Casey is really the incumbent in that race. And there was a sense that an incumbent that's below 50% is always in trouble. Now, this is a slightly different situation. That's why the 40% threshold was kind of the golden ring for that race. Mm-hmm. And he came real close. I would say statistically it's insignificant. So it's going there's no question that Brian Kemp has to attack Casey Cagle going forward.
Jen, would you imagine that's going to be the case?
Of course. I mean,
I think she's praying for it right now.
I mean, I am ready to watch these commercials over and over and over. Look, you know why he's going to do it? Because it worked. I mean, it absolutely worked. And then when you're talking about getting primary runoff voters, which is even a completely different subset, I mean, these are your red meat voters. And he's going to have to do something. And look, people are looking for excitement. And you know, Cagle acted like the incumbent.
Yeah,
and it was boring. Yeah, then you saw Kemp's commercials, and they weren't boring.
You are echoing Teresa Tomlinson's very comments about the way that some of the candidates, she talked about the white men running for office and why some of them she thinks lost, and you're kind of in her corner. Look, before we take a break, there is a candidate named Josh McCall, running, he's a Democrat, running in the 9th Congressional District against Doug Collins. I don't think many people believe that that is a district that's going to flip anytime soon. But as long as we're talking Brian Kemp, I think you ought to see listen to the audio of a commercial that McCall has put out. Anybody who's watched TV has seen Brian Kemp's commercial. He blows up things in the background. He's got a pickup truck to round up undocumented immigrants. He's got a chainsaw. We're not going to play the whole spot, but listen to what Josh McCall is using to run against a strong incumbent.
I got my chainsaw ready to go up to Washington and cut through the corruption in both parties. This is a truck. If I have to, I'm going to take this truck and round up all the immigrants in Georgia and get them a path to citizenship and decent treatment in their workplace. Yep, I just said that. This is a beautiful weapon.
And the Second Amendment protects your right to own one of these weapons. The Second Amendment also protects other people with a well-regulated militia. That's why I believe we've got to pass common sense gun laws to keep these weapons out of violent killers' hands. Now, remind me again what is required to date my daughter?
A healthy respect of the Second Amendment?
What does the Second Amendment got to do with dating my daughter?
I mean, a healthy respect of women, because women are individuals.
That's much better.
Galloway, we have to find, I don't know who did that spot for him, but it's really terrific.
Well, the background music, John Williams, was also part of the whole ambience.
That's right. All right, look, we got to get a break in, and we'll have a lot more on Political Rewind when we come back.
I'm Ira Plato. This week on Science Friday, does a robot need a face? How roboticists think about trust and partnership in the AI-riddled future. Plus, can computers make good music?
It's really us that's creating the music, but we're doing it through software.
Hear music and lyrics created by a computer, and you be the judge. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
3 o'clock this afternoon on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. I'm glad to have you all with us. Let's go ahead. Jim, I'd love to, for a few minutes, talk. We played this on the show the other day, and it's a very powerful and passionate speech that Democratic Congressman David Scott made from the well the other day. And you went on after we did that and dug into that a little bit more deeply and wrote a beautiful column about it. The farm bill was up in the House, and he had thought he was going to get some $90+ million for historically black colleges in rural areas, newer historically black colleges. Mm-hmm. He's worked on it for years.
He worked on it for 5 years. He hauled up all 19 college presidents, college and university presidents, and these are agricultural connected schools, and got them before the full agriculture committee and put together a bill, H.R. 51, that would give each of those schools $1 million a year for scholarships over 5 years, okay? Not a big sum in an $860 billion farm bill, all right? Okay, and as usually happens, this Scott's bill was wrapped into the larger farm bill. But when it was, the funding mechanism had disappeared. There was no money. It was all discretionary. And his point is that, you know, how can you, if you're a college and you want to offer somebody a 5-year high scholarship, how do you do that when you don't know when the money is coming year to year?
So we should say that David Scott has always had a reputation of working, Rusty, across party lines.
I served with him in the Senate, and we were colleagues, and I have the highest regard for David Scott.
He's
somebody who will work across the party lines.
Very collegial, and not a guy who... Go ahead, Jim.
Well, no, and remember, just last year, when Sonny Perdue was going before the Senate hearing, his Senate confirmation hearing, and people were going to start talking to him about the 56 flag in Georgia, David Scott was right at his side.
Stood up for him in the confirmation hearings.
He was paying his dues for that scholarship bill.
He is not the sort of person who we expect to have the kind of emotional reaction that he had. Let's listen to just a bit of David Scott from the floor of the United States House when he realized he was not getting the money he'd worked for 5 years to put in the bill.
This is, unfortunately, a racist farm bill. Black people in this country have suffered too long, and we need to put a stop to it. I'm here. I know that this House will not put the money back in. It was just $1 million a year for each of the 5 years to try to get people in. Every black man does not necessarily want to play football or basketball. They want to be scientists. They want to feed the future. This is a terrible bill. And I'm asking that the Senate put the $95 million back into this bill, and let's finally treat the 1890 land-grant African-American schools with the respect and the dignity that you've never given to them.
Jen, David Scott was in tears by the time he finished that speech. But the reality is the Farm Bill failed anyway.
Yeah, I think what we saw here was normally the approach to the Farm Bill is pretty bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time that it really became a partisan
fight.
Why
did it, do you think?
I'm not quite sure.
The other element in this was were the work requirements.
SNAP requirements. Yes.
Right, right. And so mm-hmm. Paul Ryan made it a partisan issue, and then he could not get it over the finish line. The problem is he's considered basically a lame duck speaker. He shouldn't have announced his retirement.
Yeah, he was in a bad spot, Rusty, because the Trump administration, with the backing of our own Sonny Perdue, said we want a work requirement for SNAP, what used to be called food stamps, and Ryan decided to push forward, as Jen says, hoping he was going to get the votes, and they were not there.
Well, he lost because of the Freedom Caucus didn't vote for it, and they were objecting to the total cost of the bill. So you had a lot of – there were a lot of fracture lines on that. And, you know, David Scott, I served with him, a wonderful human being. I disagree with him on a lot of policy issues, but as a human being and somebody who genuinely cares about these issues, there's none better. And he's got a connection to Atlanta sports. His brother-in-law is Hank Aaron. So it's you know, this is a guy who knows where he speaks, but it's just it got caught in those typical things that happen in Congress.
We don't hear the word racist used in Congress in formal settings like that.
No, and it was what was interesting. If you go to the C-SPAN video, it didn't stop when he left the podium.
That's right.
I mean, you had Mike Conaway, the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee, get up and say, "Look, we didn't take out the money. We never put the money in," and you could hear the shouting from the back of the chamber. It was David Scott saying, "You know it was there. You know it was there."
We have some people who commented on Facebook Live. David Futral, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, David. Stacey Abrams is running as a Massachusetts progressive in a center-right state. What do you think about that, Jen?
I think she's running as a Georgia progressive in a state that is going to turn blue.
Rusty, that sounded like the exact Democratic spin you'd want to put on it. She's running as a kind of a Northeastern liberal
This is, you know, I made the argument if the Democrats really wanted to win the governor's race, they would have nominated Stacey Evans because she's got a real, I think she could have pulled it off. And you're right. Stacey Abrams has rejected the normal patterns, and it's kind of like she's the Newt Gingrich of the Democratic Party today. Newt looked at the status quo and said, that's not going to work. And so he started changing the Republican Party, and Stacey's got a similar view on the left about the Democratic Party.
And quite frankly, I mean, the one of the things that I'm going to be watching is how does the rest of the ticket respond?
Yeah.
Because she's on top. I mean, she's earned the right to call the shots now. Mm-hmm. But you have we were talking about Sarah Amico and John Barrow.
Well, the John Barrow reaction is going to be especially interesting because here's the last white Democrat serving in the United States Congress from a southern state. Is he going to be able to go along with a more progressive agenda that Stacey Abrams sets up?
Right, and will Abrams cut him some slack to do what he needs to do to go to the middle?
Yeah. Kathy Rivers says she thinks Trump is a big motivator in how people voted. Senator, your colleague in the state Senate, Nakima Williams, is watching the show today, and she says on Facebook Live, "The future is blue!" Exclamation point. We wouldn't expect her. We would hope she wouldn't say anything otherwise.
Right.
All right, so we really appreciate all of your comments, and keep letting us hear from you. We love to hear your thoughts on all of this. Jim, we don't have a whole lot of time left. But I remember back when Christopher Wray was nominated to become the FBI director after James Comey was fired, after the acting U.S. attorney Sally Yates was fired, that we all wondered, is Christopher Wray walking into the biggest hornet's nest possible, leaving King and Spalding in Atlanta and going off to Washington? And I don't think we were prescient, but we were right.
Yeah, I mean, there's no indication that his job is in jeopardy.
No.
But he's being pulled into these weird little meetings.
He was yesterday part of the team from the Justice Department that was called to the Hill to give confidential briefings on what the president likes to call Spygate, and which others who have evaluated the material say no was an attempt to actually protect the Trump campaign from Russian infiltration. And there's our Chris Wray right in the middle of all of that. Rusty?
Well, you know, Comey, when he injected the FBI into the presidential race, really did tremendous harm to the FBI. And now what's happening is both parties are using the FBI to drive their own political agendas, and somehow or the other, they've got to extract themselves from the political process.
You know, Jen, I think that's a fair point, and I'd love to get your reaction. We know that right now that there are Democrats and many people beyond party affiliation who are very concerned with the way the White House is trying to polarize people around law enforcement, Justice Department. But it is true that the minute Comey decided to give a news conference to releasing information on Hillary Clinton, he changed the way the game is played to some extent, didn't he?
Yeah, and it was completely inappropriate. I mean, yeah. From my perspective, and even in his book, and he talked about this in interviews, I mean, he took politics into consideration in terms of some of the moves they made. And they're even talking about it after the fact. They thought Hillary was going to win, so they wanted to be tough on her in the public. They didn't think Trump was going to win, so they didn't announce about the Russian investigation. I mean, the rules should be the same. Period, no matter what party and no matter what's going on in the election. But in terms of Christopher Wray, he is beyond reproach. And personally, I'm glad he's there.
All right. We're really out of time for today's show, but I do have enough time to make a correction. On Wednesday's show, we mentioned that Sheikh Rahman is the first immigrant elected to the Georgia legislature. And I said he was from South of Fulton. He's not.
He's up in
Gwinnett County.
He beat Kurt Thompson.
That's right, in Tucker. And I apologize. He's from Bangladesh. And it's another sign that we're looking at a county that is just changing like crazy, Jim.
And you know, if you're Butch Conway, if you're a sheriff, or if you're a county commission chairman out there, you know, I think you've got a cap on your career now.
Yeah. All right. Well, now that's interesting. You know, everybody thought Rob Woodall was in trouble. He's one of the few that outpolled the Democrats in the metro area by a large margin, by 10,000, almost 11,000 votes.
Yeah, but we do have, and of course, we got a Democratic runoff up there. We'll keep our eye on. All right, we're completely out of time. Thank you so much, Jen Jordan, Senator Jen Jordan, for being with us today. Rusty Paul, thank you. Jim Galloway, great to have you here. Everybody out there, thanks for listening, watching, however you're getting this show right now. And if you are listening in real time, go have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday with more Political Rewind.